Thank you for inviting me here, and thanks now for organizing the trip. It's always a pleasure to be in Canada. Actually, did part of my undergrad when I was in Vancouver for a year, and it's always nice to come here to talk about quantum computation. I got interested in quantum computation when I was living in Canada, so I feel like I'm partially some Canadian product. So I think we're going to be a small group of people, so it feels free to interrupt me. I'm going to be talking about work that I did in my PhD thesis, and it's about building some intermediate models of quantum computation to understand quantum speedups in their, you know, sort of controlled scenario. So in a nutshell, the result of this talk is a series of algebraic extensions of Gottesman stabilizer formalism. I'm going to use it not for codes, but to describe quantum states. And by algebraic, what I mean is that normally the Pauli operators have certain mathematical properties. They behave normally like groups, elements, and here, or elements of finite fields. And here we're going to slightly generalize these properties and look at, you know, more general structures than regular fields, things like commutative groups, and things that are like fusion categories. You know what that is from topological quantum computation. And we're going to use these techniques to develop classical simulation methods, describe some new types of states, and ultimately try to understand certain families of quantum algorithms. So the focus of the talk is going to be like on this part, and you building up these methods to understand this part. I will mention a few potential applications of this for many body physics or codes. Some of you are probably interested in that. But the motivation of these projects started because we wanted to understand better what powers quantum computation. This is not so easy to define a question, but what we know is that there are problems like factoring that are very hard to solve in a classical computer with current algorithms. And John Martinez likes to put always these pictures in his talks. If you use a current laptop and current methods for factoring, then you can easily factor some digits as numbers with some hundreds of digits on a few months. But you multiply these by a factor, and you want to factor a 1,000 digit number, then things quickly scale up. You need some machine that covers parts of North America. You need to run this during some years, and it consumes quickly all the energy of the world. So I can only say that this is not very practical. And assuming that there is no classical algorithm for this, then we know, thanks to Peter Shor, that there is a quantum method to factor the same numbers, building a machine that covers only the space of a room, maybe, or a house. And this is something very physical, this difference in resources that we need, quantum and classically. So this is what we would like to understand, where does that come from. And the motivation to do that, on the one hand, is, I guess, from the point of view of physics, is understanding an emergent phenomenon that is not very easy to describe from just understanding the behavior of single particles. From an applied computer science point of view, one would like to use these machines to solve problems that we cannot solve currently with classical computers. And, you know, this is also not a very easy question, like developing new quantum algorithms, and especially practical ones. The current state of the art is we know many quantum algorithms, I think, and many of them exhibit super polynomial speedups over the best known classical ones. Fortunately, they are all, as per today, of a slight academic flavor. So we have very interesting algorithms for cryptographic problems, and they are obviously interesting for cryptography, and a quantum algorithm for simulating quantum systems, which are very interesting. They are probably going to be used for research, but probably a kid is not going to download one of these things into their smartphone. And there's the question of whether one day we will eventually find more practical algorithms. So people have been working on graph theoretic problems and machine learning problems, and these new advances are not still we have still not got a killer application, I would say, but maybe one day we'll get one. And I think that in order to find new algorithms, it is good to first understand where the source of the speed is coming from. So what we would like to have in the long term is a sort of theory of quantum speedups, and this is not a very well-defined concept, but it's a theory. But informally, it's something like, it's a book that you have in the library, you open it and it explains you things. And so theory of quantum speedups should explain you when a speedup does or doesn't arise. There are some obstacles to develop such a theory, and one of them is that there is no analog theory for that tells you when do you get a classical algorithm. It's sort of an art to find a new classical algorithm for a new problem. But one may hope that maybe this exists for quantum algorithms because they are more structured. Good. We don't know. But then there is also the problem of emergent physics. Like, it's hard to understand, given a description of a quantum circuit, whether it has a speed up or not. It's also impossible generally to simulate it classically with a known algorithm for that that is efficient. So it's also an obstacle. And the worst of them maybe is that sometimes, or often, or almost always, we need to rely on complexity theoretic conjectures, like P is different from NP, that has not been proven, or BPP is different from BQP. Most people believe this is the case, but ultimately we don't know. We need to make statements based on reasonable assumptions. But so today, I will talk about one approach to this problem. Let me say something. The way people try to approach this problem often is to develop resource theories, like given some subset of quantum operations that is not fully universal, how do you power it up? And tomorrow we'll talk in IQC about one of these approaches and try to understand how quantum contextuality might be a resource in magic state distillation. If you're interested, you can come by. And today I'm going to follow a different sort of approach. It's not about resource theories in the standard sense. It's more, I'm going to use some algebraic techniques to introduce some models, and I will use them to characterize some subfamily of quantum algorithms for algebraic problems. It's going to be a very special family, and the good thing is that for this family we will understand it pretty well, but it's not a full theory. That's we would like to have in the long term. The family of algorithms we investigate is closely related to Shor's algorithm. It's this family of algorithms for abelian Hindenburg problems. All of these problems have the following description. You are normally given a function, and this is a function you can query at no cost. You can evaluate it, and it acts on a group. The group is an abelian group. In the simplest case, it's finite, but can also be more complicated. You know, it's a commutative problem. And the promise is that this function is hiding structure. By that we mean that it has a periodicity. And more technically, the promise is that there is some hidden subgroup, call it H, such that when you add elements of H to, so you add some element H of this hidden subgroup to some arbitrary element G, the function doesn't distinguish these orbits. It's sort of a generalized notion of periodicity. Periodicity will be for integers, and for a hidden subgroup, this is more general. The hidden subgroup is commutative, and the function distinguishes the cosets of this subgroup. Your task is evaluating this function you can evaluate this function, and your task is to find out what the hidden subgroup is. And it can be proven that classically this is quite hard if the function is given as an oracle. There's a quantum algorithm that solves this problem, and the general structure is there is a very large quantum register here, and here you encode group elements of the group G, then you apply a Fourier transform. This is a box that prepares a very large superposition over all inputs or the function that you're given. And then you use an entangling gate to evaluate the function in parallel in a different register, all inputs of the function at once. Then you do another Fourier transform again, and you measure this big register in the standard basis. Shor's analysis then proves that using additional classical post-processing, you can use circuits of this form to factor integer numbers and compute discrete logarithms, and et cetera, et cetera. So, in fact, we can break a big number of existing crypto systems, public key crypto systems that are based on progress of these forums using these approaches. So what we're gonna find today is that, what I want to tell you is that using a generalization of stabilizer formalism, we can actually sort of describe these quantum algorithms, and we can use classical simulation techniques to understand where the speed up comes and under which scenarios. So now I'm going to introduce what these generalizations of the stabilizer formalism are. So I'm going to introduce what we call normalized circuit models. And so this is a formalism where you you choose some commutative structure. It's going to be something like an abelian group or something slightly more general. And this group is going to define a circuit model. So you're going to put inside this group, inside the machine, and you're going to have some Hilbert space labeled by the elements of this structure, group or groupoid. And the formalism associates a family of quantum circuits to a Hilbert space of this form. So the important thing here to remember is that this is a parameter that defines the models. So if I choose a different group or groupoid, I will get a different model of circuits using the construction. In the first part of the talk, I'm going to restrict myself to abelian groups. So here, this parameter G is going to be a commutative group. And we're going to define models of circuits that contain a restricted set of gates that have very specific group theoretic roles. And the first of them is going to be the quantum Fourier transform over that group. That's a gate that performs a change of basis in this group label Hilbert space. It creates large superpositions where over some set of labels. These labels are what people call the character functions of the group. And the character functions of an abelian group are basically functions that behave multiplicatively over the group. So things like this. So there are the group theoretically one can show that there are as many group elements as characters. So this is actually a well-defined operation, and one can also show that it's unitary. The other gates are either permutation unitary gates or the diagonal unitary gates. The permutation unitary gates are going to implement a specific family of permutations, which we can call affine general maps. So they are like maps of the form some function A acts on G, and A is an isomorphism of the group. So this is something that is invertible, and it splits according to the group operation. And we can also add elements of the group, like something like shifts. And the diagonal gates.
S is a parameter of the specific function. Yes,
yeah, so the S here will be another element of the same group. So this will be.
And it's a constant for all G.
Yeah, the S will define the gate. So this could be like adding S to every element. So implementing the group operation basically, if there is no A. It's like a Pauli X, so to say. The diagonal gates are implement when you multiply the elements by some phase, and this phase has a structure too. The structure that we impose is chosen to be as follows: like if the group operation is plus, then the sum of two elements G plus H is map under phi this map splits multiplicatively almost with respect to this operation. So we get some phi of g plus h is phi of g times phi h, but there is an additional term in here. And this thing is a function of g and h. This has also some restrictions. It has to be what we call a bi-character of the group. A bi-character of the group is a function that takes two elements and is multiplicative on both arguments. So maybe I can write this with a chalk. There's no chalk. Oh, yeah. So just for not to confuse, if I fix the x and I put g plus h here, this has to be equal to bgx, b h x, and the property also holds for the second variable. So we call these functions quadratic, and these are all the gates that we can allow in our quantum circuits. So these specific forms are not chosen randomly. They are, we're going to see that later, they are chosen so that they behave like certain extended Clifford gates for certain extended Pauli operators. But, and one thing that I want to inject here is that in our model, G is not subject to be a finite group. It can be also an infinite group, things that are a bit complex. So sometimes when I give these talks about this topic, some mathematicians get very mad at me because I introduce these kets and then I tell them, oh, this can be an infinite group. And these kets are not very well defined when the group is infinite because they behave like Dirac deltas, Dirac measures. And it looks pretty ugly. But there is a way to make everything I'm saying here rigorous. Normally, if you want to define these things carefully, you look at Schwarz function theory. Like these kets can be defined correctly as functionals that act on functions. And you can define the unitaries using this sort of language correctly. And if you are familiar with Schwarz function array Hilbert spaces, then yes, which you normally learn these things for groups like RM, then just believe me that there is some people who extended this to spaces labeled by group elements. But I'm just going to use that simplified notation for the rest of the talk. So what we can show about these formalism of circuits is that if we change the parameter G to be different types of groups, we can obtain families of circuits that sometimes exhibit some quantum speed up and sometimes are classically simulable. And we can kind of see how this changes by changing this parameter. So this, we can have a model to see where we can study the emergence of the quantum speedup. And in particular, if we choose the group G that defines the circuit model to be the standard integers modulo 2 n times, or the standard integers modulo d n times, the circuit model we define is equivalent to having standard qubit or q-dit Clifford circuits. So nothing changes, and these guys are officially classically simulable by the Gottesmanian theorem, so there is no computational power. We're going to put them here in this axis. This is like a picture. It's not really it's not a super precise plot, but I wanted to illustrate this. I'm going to organize the models here in computational power and with respect to their algebraic complexity. And I will not tell you yet what algebraic complexity means. I will introduce this a bit more formally later, but if we choose the group Rm, then the circuit model that we obtain is equivalent to the bosonic Gaussian unitaries, which are studied in quantum optics. These are also known to be classically simulable. And if we choose something like integers times m, or a hypertorus of rank m, what we get is a sort of Clifford group that acts on a Hilbert space labeled by charges. And these are Hilbert spaces that you see normally when you study Josephson junctions, for example, in superconducting architectures. And all of these circuits that we have here, we can prove, for some of them it's proven, for some others we prove it, that they're all classically simulable. So they don't have any, they don't exhibit any quantum speedup. But we can do some modification to the, introduce some more complicated groups, and then we obtain something interesting. Like if we add to the integers group some group of this form, this is the integers modulo n, but not with the addition, but with the multiplication. This is a multiplicative group. If you only take the integers that are co-prime to n, and it's a group that is used in cryptography, like in the RSA crypto system, then the Clifford operations that are associated to set times set n multiplicative can implement exactly a version of Schwarz factoring algorithm, where basically the Fourier transform that you use a Fourier transform over set, and then gate that you normally call the modular exponentiation in Schwarz algorithm turns out to be a sort of generalized control knot, gate with respect to this structure. By that, I mean that it's a group automorphism over this group. And that's something that we show. And you can also prove that for a different group, you can obtain Shor's discrete log algorithm as an extended Clifford circuit. And it has like this form. Here we take an additive modular group, another additive modular group, and a multiplicative modular group. By changing, making this change, adding this multiplicative group, we suddenly obtain a speed up with respect to the best classical algorithms for some problem. So we observe the emergence by changing this parameter.
I realize you said this part of the graph was kind of impressionistic anyway, but why? I normally think of Pro's algorithm as being relatively computationally powerful. Has a speed up, so, but you're putting it all the way kind of on the left.
Sorry, your question about why did I put it pictorially there? It was a problem of putting it inside the box, and it had problems with making the figure. It's just artificial.
Okay.
This is just an illustration. It's not really, I'm just trying to illustrate that there is like a phase diagram here, which, so it's the best. But don't take it too seriously. But my point is that, changing the parameter, we see this change of regime between classically efficiently classically simulable and suddenly not simulable. And we would like to understand this using some techniques. So things to take in mind here. These numbers that I need to put here for these results, like these p numbers, these n numbers, need to grow arbitrarily with a number with some parameter. So this is not like a qubit, it's a very large system. In particular, p could be 2 to the n. And the gates that I define are not really like constant gates that act on a constant number of qubits. They act on a large Hilbert space. This is something, a feature of this theory. And I need to consider integers for some results. So the way we study these circuits is by building some generalized simulation methods for these computations based in the original stabilized isomorphism ideas. So we can prove that if you have a group G and it's decomposed in a series, if it's a product of a series of standard factors, which are real numbers, integers, Hilbert tori, and finite cyclic groups, which are additive, then we have a generalized simulation method for any normalized circuit over such a group. And simulation methods, you can do standard things you can do for regular qubit stabilizer circuits. You can compute normal forms for the states that can be created by applying circuits, normalized circuits over G. They look like uniform superpositions over some subgroup or coset of the original group. This integral is supposed to be the Hauer measure over the group. And this X should be an H, not an X. This is an H, sorry. And they are like flat superpositions. And these amplitudes are very specific. They are always certain type of quadratic forms. This is something that you might know from qubit stabilizer states. They have this form for where these functions are exponentials of modular forms over 2 or modular forms over 4, things like this. And the algorithms that we have can do things like sample the final output distribution of these states or computing classical descriptions of the support of this state. That means this coset where the state is supported. We can compute these functions, like this function is defined in terms of some matrices A and B. We can compute those matrices and evaluate C with high precision, compute output probabilities, and we can also simulate intermediate measurements efficiently in finite dimensions and have some problems with infinite dimensions because of infinite precision, which we didn't address, but we believe that this should be also doable with similar techniques. And the mathematics that you need to simulate to prove this is very similar to the original stabilized formalism. But so in the original Gottesman-Neely theorem, what you do is you describe a qubit state as a plus one joint eigenstate of a group of commuting Pauli operators. So you take some Pauli X's and Pauli sets, and you take a group generated by these guys, and you use the description in terms of Paulis instead of storing the wave function of the original state. And you know that you can simulate Clifford operations by, because they send Pauli operators to Pauli operators, and these updates can be efficiently tracked. And at the end of the day, you end up with a evolved stabilizer group, and you can use number theoretic algorithms to extract the information about the state. These number theoretic algorithms look like Gaussian elimination, for example, for binary systems. This would, and for our more generalized setting, there are similar techniques that you can use. Look, we can describe quantum states in terms of groups of generalized Pauli operators. So again, we have a plus one joint eigenstate, but we change the types of Paulis. The Paulis that we use, you might be familiar from them for if you work in condensed matter. We have like a Pauli X gate, which is, well, a set series of Pauli X gates. They are labeled by elements of the group, and they are unitary gates that map the kth labeled by H to the element G plus H, where G is the label of the Pauli X. So they implement the group addition. And we also have a Pauli set gate, which they are labeled by group characters, and they send a kth labeled by H to the same kit with an additional character phase. We evaluate the function on the H and you put it in front of. So this is, these are our Paulis, and you take a stabilizer group of commuting Paulis and you use this to describe a quantum state. The gates that we introduce are basically, you can prove that they send Pauli to Paulis, and you can also efficiently compute these updates if the group is, as I said, factorized before. So if you look at these labels of the Pauli operators, the evolution of any gate, an normalizer gate, sorry, of any Pauli under conjugation by a normalizer gate, acts on these labels as follows. Let me explain this notation. So if you store the label of the Paulis, you can, the label of the evolved Pauli is related to the previous label by multiplication by a certain matrix. So you, what you need to do is compute a matrix on a string of numbers. And this matrix is dependent of the gate that you're using. Okay? So the Fourier transform has some associated matrix, and then the automorphism gates have another associated matrix. And in the end, the computation is tracked by multiplying matrices on some strings. And you end up, again, with a stabilizer group at the end. And you need to post-process the information of the state. This is not done with regular Gaussian elimination methods, but there is a sort of classical and symbolic algebraic techniques for that we apply. Basically, you do store to extract the information, you need to solve things that look like linear systems of equations over groups, like you have some homomorphisms that replace matrices, and the group elements replace vectors. And you can solve these systems using a technique for diagonalizing matrices over rings, which is called the Smith normal form. This takes like a matrix of integers and puts it in a diagonal form up to some invertible matrices. And with this, you solve systems of this form. And there is an intermediate step in here that I will not go into, but in order to extract information on the state, you need to turn the stabilizer group that we have into a sort of linear system of equations of this form. And the way we do this is to use some sort of standard techniques to analyze stabilizer groups of permutation and diagonal matrices, so of monomial matrices that were introduced by Van den Nest in this paper. And this is a sort of general technique for analyzing, you know, just any generalized stabilizer group based on monomial matrices. Things of this form can be treated in a common language using the techniques of this paper. And if you apply these techniques to our stabilizer groups, then you get these systems of equations that they have here, which you treat with these sophisticated classical algorithms. But in the end, you can do these things pretty efficiently using these methods. And we can use these to understand a bit how the speed up arises in Shor's algorithm and the Savilian Hidde-Sabut problem algorithms. So something that we prove is that, well, Shor's algorithm is not efficiently simulable with these methods. You cannot directly apply them. And the reason is that the original assumption that the group is factorized, which I mentioned, it doesn't hold by construction, because these multiplicative modular groups are not given in a factorized forms. In fact, taking a group like set n time multiplicative, decomposing it into a product of cyclic groups is always possible because every finite abelian group is isomorphic to a group of that form. But that's a complicated problem. There is no classical algorithm for it. And in this case, this problem is as hard as factoring, in fact. So it is not something that you can. So if your group is not given in the form that I wanted, then there is no efficient classical method to put it in that way. It turns out that you can actually do that with a quantum algorithm. So given a group G, which might be given as a series of generators, and maybe it's not given to you in the nice factorized form, but you might know how to multiply the elements, you ask, can you compute an isomorphism that sends this group into a group of elements that have the property that are factorized? So this notation means these new generators are linearly independent, so you multiply these elements together, you only get a zero when you multiply them you multiply everyone to zero. And you have this condition, basically you have factorized this group as something of this form, where these DIs are the orders of these elements. There are quantum algorithms to compute these orders, and there is a quantum algorithm by Cheon and Mosca that, given a set of generators of a group which is efficiently computable, whose operation is efficiently computable, you can compute a sort of matrix, AM, that of integers, that you multiply, exponentiate these guys to the entries of this matrix, and you obtain some beta guys which have this factorized property. Now, this is nice for us, but it's not enough to have just this matrix to actually to do like a full translation between this isomorphism and this isomorphism. This just tells you how to turn elements written as products of these guys into elements that are products of these guys. But if you want to compute the full isomorphism between the two groups, you need to compute something extra. And this is something that we show how to do. Like, we also prove that you can compute a matrix beta using some additional quantum algorithm that sends the elements of these guys to these elements. So you multiply some integers, you exponentiate these guys to some strings of integers, and then you get the alphas back. Then you can basically turn the original encoding in terms of generators of G into the other encoding in terms of factorized in terms of these generators which are independent and give rise to this nice factorizable representation. So this is what it's interesting about this problem is that once we have this factorized decomposition, we can apply our classical simulation algorithms to simulate a normalized circuit. So what this algorithm tells us is that if you have an oracle to actually solve this problem, then Shor's algorithm will be simulable. So the quantum algorithm that we actually use here is also a normalizer circuit over a certain group, which is of abelian, and it belongs to our model. And if you put all these things together, what you obtain is a classification of the computational power of the circuit models over groups. So basically, we have argued that there is a normalized circuit that turns any group into a factorized form and tells you how to do the conversion between them two. And we have also discussed that you can also simulate any normalized circuit over a factorized group given the factorized decomposition. So if we put these things together, it means that once you have solved this problem using a normalized circuit, it is actually it's impossible for you to find a new quantum algorithm based on these operations, which is not simulable by non-quantum algorithms that already existed. So you can, if what I'm saying is that you would actually combine lots of normalizer gates in a very sophisticated array, you could use the algorithm for group decomposition and classical post-processing. So this is the algorithm for group decomposition. And it is a classical computer to simulate the any other more potentially more sophisticated quantum algorithm. Okay. So, and in fact, this quantum algorithm that we use for this problem has a very simple way of shape. It's basically similar to Shor's algorithm. It has a Fourier transform, control exponentiation operation, and another Fourier transform. So the moral of these results combined is that in this big diagram that we had before, we can not only see the emergence of the speedup, we can basically characterize when it will happen and when it doesn't happen. So it will only happen if the group that we have is big, and it will only happen if we don't know the group decomposition. So knowing this group decomposition is a measure of algebraic complexity in a way. It's also a measure of your available knowledge. It's not of, and it's basically the simplest measure we can give right now. But it tells you, this characterizes everything about the power of these normalized circuits over groups. And all of this is modulo the assumption that there is no classical algorithm for the same problem, which is efficient. So with here, I would like to discuss a bit the role of resources in these circuits. So we know that the stabilizer formalism, the original one, is a good source of examples of quantum circuits that have interesting properties. They exhibit high degrees of entanglement as measured by different measures, but for example, the Schmidt rank. And they also exhibit high degrees of interference. And on the other hand, these resources are not used in a way that leads to quantum speedup. So because they are simulable by the Gottesman-Newman theorem. So I just want to tell you some new things that we learn about these resources in this generalized algebraic stabilizer formalism. So for concerning entanglement, we can actually, with respect to our simulation methods, entanglement may or may not be an obstacle to simulate a quantum circuit. So in fact, imagine that we make something that I will call a Shor lasagna. It's like you take Shor's algorithm and then you put it in parallel many times and then you shift it and you concatenate it with itself. And then you make a sort of lasagna of circuits of this form. So this is not simulable if you don't know the factorization of your number, or if you don't know the group decomposition. But if you have knowledge of the group decomposition, which is basically a string of data, then there is a classical algorithm that simulates this. And the entanglement doesn't change. The only thing that changes is your available knowledge about the algebraic structure of the circuit. So basically what we have learned is that entanglement in this model doesn't give you a speedup necessarily, or is not actually clearly the source of speedup. It's less important than the knowledge of the group decomposition. And something that we learn about interference is that, you know, there are actually for some examples of quantum circuits that have the form, that are the form Fourier transform, and then some permutation classical gate, and then another Fourier transform. It was proven by Schwarz and van den Nest that if there is too much interference in the quantum algorithm measure, then the algorithm becomes classically simulable. And the way they measure interference is that if the circuit somehow has a very sparse peak output distribution of outcomes, then meaning that there are so many cancellations when you do the Fourier transform that almost all the possible probabilities, but a very few ones, cancel, then there's a classical algorithm that gives you an approximation of the final state. And you can actually classically simulate the final output distribution by computing it. And basically, it is quite likely that, well, I would say that we don't fully know whether this extends to the entire normalized circuit formalism, but there is strong evidence that this is the case, because we have proven in our papers that any normalized circuit can be decomposed as a sequence of circuits that are of this FTF form. And it is quite plausible that, so Schwarz and Mathan and Nesson proved the result for Hadamard gates and discrete Fourier transform over 2 to the n. But it's quite likely that this is also generalized to arbitrary Fourier transforms over groups. And if that is the case, then in any quantum circuit on our model, then interference is being exploited, because otherwise you don't have superpositions and cancellations, but it's being used in a sort of moderate way. So that's a nice thing. Now, I would like to say something about contextuality. So as you know, there are some like more recent works that started here in IQC and continued by other people, including us. Understanding contextuality is a resource of speed up or universality in magic state distillation. And the current state of the art in this area is that it is a resource, contextuality is a resource for all prime dimensions. If you use Clifford gates, in the sense that the magic state needs to exhibit contextuality for being useful. And now we also know that this is true for any two-level scheme based on Clifford operations, but there you need a promise. And the promise that you need is that there is a phenomenon called state-independent contextuality is not present in the measurements of the scheme. There is currently, there are some problems to get rid of this property, and it would be nice to apply these normalized circuit techniques to actually understand this better, because something that is interesting is that when you use the stabilizer formalism or the normalized circuit formalism, there is no fundamental, well, there are some distinctions between odd and even dimensions, but the classical simulability is not affected. So there, it is strange that there is this difference when you look at contextuality. So it would be nice to kind of try to generalize this, I think. So I'm going to change to another part of the talk when I'm not going to talk about groups anymore. If you have any questions about the group part, you can ask me now or later. But otherwise, I will tell you about a different type of normalized circuits that we studied more recently. They are based on some different algebraic structures. And so we have a no-go theorem for finding new quantum algorithms within the previous model, and we wanted to basically bypass our own theorem to possibly find new quantum algorithms. And then we, you know, there is a standard approach to generalize these abelian Heidegger problems by turning the group into non-commutative. And then that defines a new problem, which is interesting, has applications in complexity theory and cryptography, and it has not been solved for a while. People have tried to solve this problem in 14 years, and there is only very little progress in that area. So what we do here is try to take a different approach. When you cannot solve a problem, then you use something different. We look at, instead of non-abelian non-commutative groups, we look at commutative hypergroups. These are something very, very similar to a fusion category, fusion algebra. You know what that is from topological quantum computation. These are algebraic structures that describe multiplication of non-anionic particles, or things that look like non-abelian anions. And the intuition why we decided to look at that is because these algebraic structures can arise from groups when you make, when you look at conjugacy classes, you only look at structures that are invariant under conjugation. It is known that the Heidegger problem is easier when the subgroup is normal, meaning invariant under conjugation. And we basically, this was a motivation to look into these structures. And the second motivation is that we could actually link these structures to a more general stabilizer formalism. So I will give you a survey of these hypergroups, or if you know anions, then you can pretty much ignore this description. There are very few differences with fusion categories. So hypergroups are like commutative algebras, which have a very specific basis. And this basis can be interpreted as a set of particles in the following sets. So the basis are some things that you can multiply together. That's why it's an algebra. So A times B means multiplication. If you multiply the element, the basis element A with the basis element B, you get a classical, so to say, superposition. Like this is a sum of vectors in this algebra over the basis, where these coefficients have a very specific structure. And this structure is what it gives meaning to the whole thing. So the structure is such that you can interpret these things as probabilities. They are non-negative numbers. And very often, they can be rescaled to make it a probability distribution. And I'm going to assume that for the rest of the talk. It has group-like properties, like commutative group-like properties. So the operation is commutative. It's associative. And the thing that is interesting is that it's not invertible. So when you multiply A and B, you can get many objects. That is what it's called hypergroup for, because you get many things. So it's a hyper operation. But there is a vacuum, which is like a unit of the algebra. And the interesting thing is that for every A, there is an anti-A, A star, which is like an inverse. It gives you, with some probability, non-zero probability, the vacuum is the only particle that has that probability. And but there is also a string of other potential outcomes that can appear at the same time. And these particles have associated, these particles or basis elements have associated some weights, which is basically this function, which is the inverse probability of getting the vacuum when you fuse A with anti-A. And in anionic theories, these are related to the quantum dimensions of the particles. So an example of this, we are anion theories for topological quantum field theories on topological quantum computation. There you have these structures called fusion categories. They are exactly things of this form where the numbers are non-negative integers. The vacuum only can appear exactly one time. And mathematicians know that these objects can be normalized by dividing the particle A by its quantum dimension. The quantum dimension is, in this case, the square root of the weight. And if you do that renormalization, then you obtain a hypergraph. It's not very interesting for what I'm going to say next, so I just want to mention that. The connection with groups is that if you take a group, original group can be abelian or non-abelian, let's say commutative or non-commutative, G. I can write a polynomial over the group algebra. So I write a superposition of elements G, A, J minus, where these elements are drawn from a conjugacy class C, A. And I'm going to call this polynomial divided by the order of the conjugacy class just the conjugacy class. This is a way to represent a conjugacy class. If you multiply this polynomial together, people can prove that you obtain a commutative algebra with exactly these properties. And there is another second hypergroup associated to the same group G, which is defined in terms of the characters. So this C over here is going to be some finite group character, the trace of some irreducible representation. So irreducible is important. You take one character, you divide it by the dimension of the representation, and then you obtain a renormalized function. If you multiply these functions pointwise, then the power of some chi of mu with some chi of nu gives a string of chis of gammas, and these coefficients here have, again, all of these hypergroup properties. So this is basically called the harmonic analysis of these hypergroups. And it's very similar to the theory of finite abelian groups in the sense that these objects are dual, in the sense that there is something that you can define for any hypergroup, in particular for the class hypergroup. You can define character functions. These are not the original finite group characters. These are not original. In principle, these things are different, although they turn out to be the same. Like, the hypergroup characters are defined so that if you have the product of two of these particles and you apply a character, the function splits, and it respects the fusion operation, and it's non-zero. If it's non-zero, it's trivial, but it has to be non-zero. It turns out that for this particular example, these functions that with this definition are exactly these functions that you have here, and it turns out that due to this other property, the hypergroup characters of the character hypergroup are the class hypergroup elements. So just like finite abelian groups and their characters are dual, finite hypergroups have this property as well. And this is nice because allows us to define a stabilizer formalism. So, and this is done as follows. Having a particular hypergroup, you define a Pauli X, well, a set of Pauli X's and a set of Pauli C's. The X's are labeled by some anions or particles, and the sets are labeled by the hypergroup characters of those particles. And this operation it basically realizes the multiplication of the original particle theory or hypergroup, and the set realizes the multiplication of the character hypergroup, which is associated to it. And they can be writing as matrices like this. This thing is basically taking A, fusing it with B, creating a string of C's with the right probabilities, and it's rescaled with the dimensions of the particles A, B, and C. And the set, the seed, multiplies by the character that labels the operation, the operator, the character, the ket B. So these Paulis are a bit funny because they are not group elements. They are not invertible. They are non-unitary. And the X guy here is non-sparse. Well, it may not be sparse. The Pauli X matrices have one non-negative, one non-zero entropy in Rouen Colo, and exactly one, so they are monomial. And because this is a hyperoperation, here you can get several numbers in different rows and columns. So they're kind of different, and you cannot use standard monomial matrix techniques to describe these stabilizers. So we can use them to describe some types of new states by writing very simple types of hypergroups as a stabilizer hypergroups. So we take now a hypergroup generated by some X's, so they form a closed thing under multiplication, and we get another one of Z's. We take them such that they commute, and one can prove that these guys commute if and only if their labels form certain dual hypergroups that have this property that if we call the set of particles N, then this set of particles have belong to some N orthogonal. N orthogonal is the set of characters that map the A's to 1. And in order to define a state, you look at the an eigen joint eigenspace of these two hypergroups. It turns out that this is only well defined, uniquely well defined, if you take N and N orthogonal to be maximal. But this construction is generic. It always works. We are a bit limited. So basically, what we're describing here is a generalized form of a CSS stabilizer group. So you would think in terms of standard qubit codes, this would define a sort of CSS stabilizer state because it has X's and Z's. And we can have a normal form from these states, which is very similar to the form that we had previously for groups. You have a superposition over a set, which is of the form C belongs to B times N, where N is a closed hypergroup. We have a uniform superposition over all elements that you obtain by multiplying B, N with some B. And sorry, I cannot see this. So this is a C, so there is a typo here. This A and this A should be this C. So this should be an A, or this should be a C. Basically, you can get some faces here, which are some characters that are depending on the joint eigenspace of these guys that you choose. Okay, so this is loosely speaking what we can do. Although it looks very, N is a chosen subhypergroup of the original hypergroup. So it's like a closed fusion subalgebra. And if you take that closed fusion subalgebra, you define N orthogonal to be its all characters that have that property. If you take that to be maximum, there is a, then the, for example, plus one eigenspace of this thing is, well, actually, it's not plus one. I think it's a, let me think. Yeah, the plus one joint eigenspace of these guys is well defined, and there is a certain number. All the eigenspaces of these stabilizer hypergroup are associated to characters. Those that correspond to invertible characters are lead to uniquely defined stabilizer states, and the other ones lead to some mixed states that we don't understand very well, but they describe also some state. Okay, so I wanted to say that we were trying to define this purely in an abstract way, but I was seeing some talks in QEC and this year in Benasque in the Fault Tolerant Quantum Technology meeting, and apparently these Paulis are related to some protected gates investigated by Beaverland, Washapar, Kearney, Pastavky, Preskill, Seeher. And these guys have a paper on this thing called locality preserving topological gates. And in the context of topological codes on manifolds, you have the non-conductible, these non-conductible errors on loops. And these errors are described by certain string-like operators, which can be proven to be equivalent to these X's and Z's for the torus up to a normalization. And some results of these people, and now some evaluations, as far as I know, result from Alagic, Beaverland, and Bombing, it was announced by Koenig in the workshop, proves that you have the torus manifold. If you look at the Clifford gates of the associated hypergroup stabilizers, these protected gates are contained strictly in that Clifford group. So it's a quite cool connection. It's not complete. You don't have things like Fourier transforms in this protected gate setting. We have things like Fourier transforms in our hypergroup setting, so it's more general. This has not been generalized to multiple manifolds or manifolds with holes. So it would be interesting to actually do that, because we could potentially get a hyperstabilizer description of these locality preserving gates, which are rather complex and might actually help you to do things like magic state distillation for those codes, or understanding the resources that make those gates universal. And okay, I will give you an example of a hypergroup. So if you start with the original quaternion group, you take look at the conjugacy classes of the quaternions. And the conjugacy classes, you can prove that there are exactly 5 conjugacy classes, and they are the vertices of this graph, I, j, plus minus I, plus minus j, plus minus k, 1, minus 1. And this graph summarizes all possible multiplications that you have in this hypergroup. The vertices are, this denotes multiplication of this guy in this direction by I. If you multiply plus minus I, this is a conjugacy class, with plus minus I, which is itself, you get with some probability 1 and minus 1. So you have 2 potential outcomes. This would be a group, there would only be such a stick. So this is a more, it is actually, you can see it, understand it as a hypergraph. These double links are the difference. And here are some examples I drew of hypergroup Clifford operations, which are the ones that stabilize the associated Paulis. And I just want to illustrate here that this defines a QD to dimension 5, and it is just the gates that we actually get as Clifford are not the standard QD Clifford gates for dimension 5. So you can actually, so this is kind of cool, you work with these intermediate models of computation, because you can define new families of Clifford gates by choosing any hypergroup, and you could use this to define a qubit, and you will get different families of gates depending on what you choose, which are not in the original stabilizer formalism. And these are all non-entangling gates. You can see some examples of entangling gates for this particular example in our paper. So there is a gate for 2 qubits that creates an entangled state of Schmidt rank 4, which is almost maximum. So you have an entangling gates here. And I will just finish by mentioning what is the quantum algorithm connection. So the problem that we look at is basically the extension of the abelian hidden subgroup problem. But as I said, instead of removing the abelian, I remove the subgroup. We take a function that hides the elements of a hypergroup of a hypergroup. And by hiding, what we mean is that now we have some hidden subhypergroup H. If we take the elements H of the H, we can associate define orbits of elements by multiplication or hypermultiplication. So we send some A via H to a string of Bs, and these are the Bs that you can reach from A. And the function will distinguish these paths. Like if two elements are connected via such a path, they will get a unique index by the function. And basically, the function will associate colors to all of the elements in such a way that elements that are connected get the same color. So for example, if you get a hidden, in the quaternion example, a hidden subhypergroup is could be 1 minus 1 plus minus I. This is a subhypergroup of that theory. This is a function that hides that subhypergroup. So basically, in this problem, you will get a description of this graph. You could actually evaluate the color of each element, each vertex. So the function tells you the color, and you have to find out that the hidden subhypergroup is that guy.
It's a non-abelian hypergroup or
abelian? Yeah. All hypergroups we consider are commutative, abelian. Sorry, so it's abelian in the sense that this operation is always commutative. So it's like the fusion. But if you think of these things as anions, they are non-abelian anions. So that was your question?
She wrote the word
non-abelian
on your
slide.
Sorry.
Here?
On the left.
Yeah, I'm confusing this. I probably meant non-abelian in the anionic sense, but so I mean it's a non-abelian subhypergroup in the anionic sense because it has a non-abelian particle. Sorry. So plus minus one is not invertible. So sorry, that's what I meant. Okay, so the thing about this problem is there are two good things, one good thing and a one bad thing about this problem. A good thing is that we think it's much easier than the non-abelian HSP. The reason why we think that is we can give a quantum algorithm that kind of returns the hidden hypergroup with some probability. And for a large family of hypergroups, this convergence is extremely fast, is polynomial in the number of iterations. It is a result which is very similar to this quantum algorithm for normal hidden subgroups by Halgren, Russell, and Tashma, which also converges fast to any normal hidden subgroup. And this algorithm works well for a large family of hypergroups that have a sort of factor series. They have like a chain of hypergroups such that you can define quotients for these guys, and the quotients turn out to be groups which are abelian. And it also works for some other hypergroups, like hypergroups of conjugacy classes related to nilpotent groups, symmetric groups, and dihedral groups. So this is not a fully efficient quantum algorithm. It's very hard to analyze these algorithms in full generality because they are very abstract, and you cannot just get an efficient Fourier transform for free. You have to prove it. So this kind of works with some oracles for having quantum Fourier transforms over these hypergroups, and some oracles here to do intersection of the hypergroups. Okay. So what we can actually say, if you look at conjugacy class hypergroups of groups, in cases where you, in many cases where you have a hard or unsolved non-abelian hypergroup, non-abelian hidden subgroup problem, the associated subhypergroup problem, commutative subhypergroup problem, turns out to be easy. So these hidden subgroup problems normally require, you know, some normal subgroup intersection oracle. Given those oracles, we get, for example, an efficient problem where we look at dihedral group conjugacy classes, whereas the dihedral hidden subgroup problem is a widely unsolved problem. People have tried to solve that case because of connections with lattice crypto systems, and it's very hard. And in this case, you get something efficient. And it also works for nilpotent groups, which are also a class of interest in that area, and which whose non-abelian hidden subhypergroup analog is, the nilpotent hidden subgroup problem, the nilpotent group hidden subgroup problem is unsolved. The associated nilpotent subhypergroup problem for conjugacy class subhypergroups of nilpotent groups is easy in this setting. So, yeah, the good news is that there are quite a few indications that this is more approachable for a quantum computer. And the bad news is that we don't have any application of this right now. Like, I cannot link this to any cryptographic problem or a graph isomorphism or something like this. That is something it would be nice to have, but we couldn't find one yet. We are hopeful that maybe there are problems associated to anionic theories or in cryptography that might be related to this hypergroup problem. I would like to mention that this hypergroup problem, we discovered that it was actually introduced by a group of people that work in pure math, and they're called Amini Kalantar and Ross Behani. They gave a quantum algorithm, which is like a single instance of Fourier sampling, where this is a Fourier transform that applies this oracle function in parallel again. It's like Shor's algorithm, and this is the standard Fourier transform of the hypergroup. And they stopped there. And this algorithm wasn't proven to converge. It actually can be proven not to converge for very simple hypergroups, like the conjugacy classes of the Weyl Heisenberg groups. And this is actually a very simple instance for when you work in this hidden subgroup business. What we did is basically concatenate this algorithm whenever you get a character. Basically, this Fourier transform maps elements to characters. You're measuring characters here. When your character is not trivial, you intersect the original hypergroup where you're searching here with the orthogonal of that character that you got, and then you get a smaller hypergroup. And then you iterate this. And that's the philosophy of the algorithm. And if you do this, it turns out to be much more efficient than the algorithm given in this paper. So that's what we needed. So I will summarize. So in this talk, we basically constructed a formalism of restricted quantum circuits that generalize the standard Clifford gates. and gave simulation techniques to analyze these quantum these circuits. Study the when you get a speedup, we link them to Shor's algorithm. Use the same techniques to understand the emergence of the speedup in Shor's algorithm and related quantum algorithms. Find some new algorithms too, and we connected these to the stabilizer formalism. So somehow, it is nice that we can actually use techniques developed for quantum error correction to study these models of computation. Some of them questions. So we have no idea whether something like this can be done for other families of circuits, but it would be very nice to have it. Maybe, for example, for it would be easier to do something like this for a non-universal model of computation like IQP circuits or match gates. But I don't. We there is room for progress in there. We I mentioned this already. We would be nice to have applications for quantum algorithms. So I also mentioned this one about contextuality. And beyond quantum algorithms, something that we don't know is whether one can use these generalized stabilizers to describe, find a quantum error correcting code, and whether that code would be good or not. Like, that's completely open. And our hypergroup stabilizer formalism gives rise to many types of gates. But we, because of the limitations of the stabilizer formalism techniques for describing non-monomial matrices, or the available ones, we cannot simulate all of the Clifford gates that we have, and that is tricky. So in particular, we cannot simulate things like partial Fourier transforms or these quadratic phase gates. And it would be interesting to generalize these methods in particular if they turn out to be connected to these locality-preserving topological gates, because that basically would tell you whether generically whether they're simulable or not, or what you need to add to them so that they do not remain classically simulable. With this, I would like to finish my talk and thank you for your attention.